Welcome to the Be Curious podcast, the podcast that champions solutions to some of the world's biggest problems. I'm your host, Louise Houghton, and in every episode, we get curious about a different subject, from the food we eat and the clothes we wear to overflowing landfills and ocean plastic. All of our guests have brilliant minds and innovative ideas to allow us to lead a more sustainable, conscious, and pollutant-free life. And the best part is, this podcast isn't just about listening. It's about building a community and connecting like-minded individuals who are curious about alternative ways to enhance their lives and the longevity of the planet. And if you're curious already and you want to find out more about the many giveaways that we have from our guests who've been on the show, then why not head over to our Instagram to enter the competitions? You can see how to do that at becurious_podcast. I am so excited to be bringing the stories in this podcast to you all. It is such a pleasure to share what companies and organizations are doing for future generations. Everyone featured works in a sustainable way, and I love how much people are on the same page, wanting to create and innovate in order to make change. If you feel the same, then why not follow in my footsteps and sign the Science Declaration? This declaration is a call to all nations, societies, and organizations to devote more resources to the advancements of science and technology. They're encouraging people internationally to join forces in battling debilitating diseases, ensuring sufficient food for a growing world population, stopping the destruction of our environment, and engaging in joint endeavors to elucidate the secrets this fascinating universe holds. To add your name, go to make-science-not-war.org and take an active stand to demand more money is put into improving rather than destroying our world. You can also hear more about this declaration at the Future Insight Conference that's being held in Mainz, Germany on the 10th and 11th of July. Over the 2 days, academic and industry leaders will come together to share their knowledge and latest innovations. The conference focuses on interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary conversations and will cover topics of science, technology, and everything else making huge steps forward in their prospective industries. You're also welcome to enter competitions and contribute to their dream board, a place that allows you to dream big and share your visions for the future, what you want to see invented, and why. It's really your chance to get involved and take an active role in leaving the planet in a better place than when you were born onto it. That's how I see it anyway, and I hope you share the same view. To check out the competitions, get tickets, or write out your dreams, head to curiousfutureinsight.org for more information. Today, we're getting curious about our immunity and how our emotions and our thoughts can affect our physical health. It makes sense that if we're stressed, our bodies are less able to fight disease. So today, we're going to dive into that subject in more detail and talk about Western medicine and compare that to a more holistic approach. To join me for this conversation, all the way from Israel, I'd like to welcome Asya Rolls, who is an Israeli neuroimmunologist. And in 2018, she was selected as an international Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator. She's also a professor at the Immunology and Center of Neuroscience at Technion within the Israel Institute of Technology. Thank you so much for joining me, Asya.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Now, there's so much to get through within this conversation today, so many different angles that we are curious about and want to explore. And I'm excited to meet you at the Curious 2024 Future Insight Conference coming up in Germany in July. I know you're going to be one of the speakers there, and I just shared some information on that with our listeners, so maybe they'll be joining us as well. We're going to get a little preview of your keynote now in this interview. So I'm really happy that you're joining us. Can you start by telling me a little bit more about your research in general?
So basically what we are interested in understanding how thoughts and emotions eventually change our physiology. We're looking at that specifically on the angle of the immune system, because this is the system that eventually does all the maintenance, is responsible for most of our sustain health. So what we are trying to understand is, how does it happen? What exactly the mechanisms that allow this communication between the brain and the immune system, with kind of long-term goal of harnessing this potential, that it will not remain kind of obscure or episodic phenomena, but actually something that we can utilize.
And where did the idea for this research actually come from?
Actually, I think I'm one of those people who are intuitively drawn to this mind-body connection, because I think I feel it very strongly on myself. And I know how when I'm stressed, I can just count the days until I'm sick. Or when I have a deadline, I know exactly I will not get sick. I will get later. And I kind of one of those that feel it very strongly on myself. And I think over the years, the evidence kind of the placebo effect has been there. And I felt like it's ridiculous that we just don't get it. How come one of the most effective drugs, which is a sugar pill?
Can you explain that a little bit more, this sugar drug, for people who don't know?
So actually, since I think the 50s, half of the patients are getting this placebo, which is a sugar pill that just looks exactly like the actual drug, and half are getting the actual drug. And neither the clinician nor the recipients are getting know what they are getting. And then we can kind of extract the part that comes from the actual pharmacology. But what is striking that we constantly see that there is also a part that comes from the patient's expectations and their desire to be cured.
Yes, is the expectation that the drug will cure them rather than anything else, whereas really their mind is then curing them, if you like, because their mind is saying, hey, I'm going to get better. And so the body naturally kind of healing itself in whatever way that it is actually designed to do naturally.
The researchers tried to kind of dissect this phenomenon of placebo into more or less two kind of mechanisms that can account for that. One is this hope that, as you mentioned, this expectation. And the other is conditioning, that we kind of have experience with previous drugs that we received, and it can initiate some kind of mechanism that the brain already have a frame of how to initiate some kind of repair mechanism, and it will use the same mechanism and kind of activate that. So we have this general framework of how it can work, but we have really fascinating evidence about that, like psychologically, just looking at it psychologically. First, it doesn't work on everyone. It's not that everyone will respond to placebo. Not every disease has the same extent of placebo response. Some diseases are much more prone to placebo responses, while others less. And there are really interesting differences between countries. So not in every country people respond to placebo to the same extent.
It does. So somebody would respond in one country better to a placebo than in another.
It seems to be related to several factors, and all of them are kind of speculations, but it's related a lot to how much respect there is to the clinician, how much trust there is with the clinicians, how much tolerance individuals have to pain, for example. So some countries where pain is more acceptable versus other countries where pain is much less tolerated. In fact, there was a study, an evaluation of 34 meta-analysis of 34 clinical trials that were done in the US in the context of pain. And they showed that most of the modern drugs will not pass the FDA because the new drug is not much better than the placebo. But actually, what is amazing is not that we got so bad in creating new drugs, is that actually people in the placebo group are responding much more. So, and it's mainly in the US. But the thing that really kills a clinical trial, and this is surprising, is if there is a dedicated nurse.
To an individual?
Not for individual. A nurse that all she does, it runs the clinical trial. So then she has time to talk to the patients and give them all their attention. And she's on all her focus is this clinical trial. So patients are just this attention that they're receiving, either because they're considering the trial to be very important, and that's why the company is investing so much money in the drug, or just because of the attention that they're getting from a medical practitioner. So it seems to affect a lot the outcomes.
So interesting. I was just watching a documentary recently about blue zones, actually. And they were sort of saying within those blue zones where people are living to over 100, that they're some of the like happiest places in the world. Community there, there's like health support. And I wonder then, I was doing some research on what are the happiest places in the world to live. And according to the 2024 World Happiest Report done after the International Day of Happiness on the 20th of March this year, they ranked Finland as the number one place to live, which actually was for the seventh year running. And if you think about it, you know, a lot of people might think, oh, Scandinavia, you know, it's cold, it's dark, you know, half the year in some of the northern parts of Finland anyway. But it's so interesting that they have all of these different other things going on whereby it makes them the happiest place. And because of that, I think, you know, their health system is also very good. They have, very good health in general. So what are your thoughts on that and actually where you live and that coinciding with happiness and your health?
So I think there are quite a lot of studies trying to establish connections between one's social interactions and how, like, as you mentioned, this sense of community. And we know that social support actually seems to correlate with some health benefits. And even something that I find even more fascinating is people that volunteer and have sense of purpose in life. Steve Cole, who's a researcher in UCLA, showed that there are some correlations between their immune system and this sense of purpose in life. And it will manifest differently in different societies. It's really hard to kind of parse them out and establish causality. That is something that's why we're trying to move in to understand the mechanisms. But the correlations are amazing. And even, you know, you can even think of having sense of belief, and it can be belief, some religious forms of belief or different forms of community, belief in a community, or these connections seem to affect health.
And those things are actually kind of a lot inbred in culture and how you're brought up as well, and what kind of mindset you have, you know. And I noticed that having lived in different parts of the world and traveled a lot. And I think if you look at, this ranking, especially this year, there's so many of those countries are actually in Europe. For people who are interested, I'll read them out. We've got followed in second place by Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Israel, and the Netherlands. So European countries, including Norway, Switzerland, and Luxembourg, really dominated the rest of the top 10 there. I think the US came in at 23rd place.
It's interesting. I would think that also weather will have something to do with that, and food, and kind of the way family gathers. If there are a lot of gathering or people are more isolated because of the snow, and it creates all these different structures in society that amazingly will then potentially affect health.
So why is it so important, do you think, that we need to establish this connection between mind and body?
We see it in all this disease that we kind of say, oh, this is a psychosomatic disease, and then we discard them. So we know that a lot of conditions, including Crohn's and recurring episodes that are of different autoimmune disease, are triggered by stress. Mm-hmm. We have nothing to do with that. At this point, because we so don't understand the connections, we treat the symptoms, but there is an actual potential to treat the cause or go deeper and treat the origin on what triggers the disease every time. And I think there is a huge potential.
So what are the reasons then, do you think, that the body is so affected? Is it just stress, or there are other things that might affect it in a similar way?
Everything, basically everything that happens in our mind, or to begin with, we need to have synchronization between our mind or our mental state, our motivations, what we want to do, and our physiology. You can see it in the smallest version that when you're excited, then the body starts to be pumps up, expecting something, right? So these expectations are built in our physiology, and even Pavlovian conditioning, the connections that dogs were receiving food and just expecting the food initiates the activity of our gut. These are really critical functions to synchronize between the body and the benefits of the brain in its ability to predict what is going to happen and then to initiate corrective processes, in its ability to anticipate and synchronize between metabolism, blood flow, immune activity. All of these can be synchronized only by the brain.
And as an example, we know about that already. You know, we know that our eyes, you know, if we cut our finger, for example, we know that our eyes see that and then our brain like tells us it's painful. And then that connects to the mouth to say, ow, you know, so we already know a lot about these neurotransmitters that are going through our bodies.
This connection is very well established. And one of the, I think one of the most kind of bursting fields in biomedicine is vagal stimulation. So they're putting kind of stimulator to the vagus, and this seems to attenuate the inflammatory response. And this is something that was discovered by Kevin Tracy already more than 20 years ago, when he showed that actually there are kind of centers in the brain that just recognize the inflammation, and then they can suppress the immune system. And now there are several really classical paper that came out and kind of deciphered the mechanisms that allow that to happen. So this is something that happens in a very basic response, like heartbeat. It's almost regulated like autonomically.
And it's always inflammation that affects the vagus nerve?
So the vagus nerve responds to the inflammation. It can sense the inflammatory response. But basically, it's a very almost reflex-like response. You sense the brain senses inflammation and initiates a suppressive response. But on top of that, if we're thinking about the cortex and all the other brain areas that evolved in higher organisms and allow more to synchronize motivations, to synchronize our emotional states, to synchronize all of those into the activity of the immune system, then I think we are starting to talk about all these psychosomatic conditions.
If you're like me, then you're curious about the future and what that will look like for our children and our children's children. A great place to feed my curiosity is at the Curious Future Insight Conference that happens every other year. I've already got my tickets to head to Mainz, Germany on the 10th and 11th of July for this year's edition. Over the 2 days, academic and industry leaders will come together to share their knowledge and their latest innovations. They will talk about the problems we're encountering on a global scale, but this is not a conference that focuses on everything going wrong. Quite the opposite. The Future Insight Conference is a really positive and uplifting place to be because the speakers have been working for years on solutions. From major players like Merck to startups only a few months old, the lineup of keynotes and panels really show the seniority in each industry. And the best part is that everyone is talking about what they're doing to make a difference in the world. This year, among many others, they have the CEO of BioNTech, Ugur Sahin, the founder of Boston Dynamics, Mark Ribert, and also the Nobel Prize winner and professor, Stephen Chu. It's a place where you can connect with like-minded individuals in academia and industry, take part in workshops like the Microplastics Hackathon, and you may even be interested in entering yourself or your company into one of the many competitions they have running annually. They have the Nature Spinoff Prize, Science and Shorts Prize, and the Future Insight Prize is the creme de la creme, awarding €500,000 as a helpful research grant. If you want to find out more about the event and grab your tickets, head over to curiousfutureinsight.org to find out more information. I'll also put a link to the page in the show notes. And if you do come and you see me there, please don't be shy and say hi. It would be such a pleasure to connect with you all.
Tell me a bit more about your research. How do you do these studies?
What we are doing is we are trying to identify brain areas from human studies. For example, we know in placebo there is a brain area that is activated in humans. It's an area called the reward system. It's an area that is kind of involved in positive expectations. And there is a correlation between the extent of this brain area activation and the extent of the placebo response that one shows. So there is a correlation there. And we said, okay, so can the activity of this area in turn change the immune response? So what we can do now, and this is one of the major, I think, advancements in neuroscience in the last 20 years, is that we can now activate specific neurons. basically with like a remote control. So we can activate specific neurons. So we activated these brain areas in mice and looked on the response on the immune system. And we found that we could improve the antibacterial immune response. We could improve anti-tumor, and it resulted in 50% reduction in the tumor size. Right now, we're about to publish a paper on how it can also even improve recovery from heart attacks. Still in the preclinical phase, so we're still deciphering it, hoping with the long-term goal that it can then be translated to humans.
So fascinating. Thank you for doing this research as well. I mean, I certainly know, you know, when we talk about this mind-body connection, I certainly know that if I've been stressed sitting at my desk all day, you know, that my shoulders would probably seize up. But my question there is, how do I know that that's stress that's caused my shoulders to seize up and not just sitting at a desk all day? You know, it could be one thing or the other.
It could be. But what is even more amazing, that the two will communicate. So having a stressed body or like cramped muscles can also signal to your brain that you are stressed, even if you are not. So there are some studies that were done, for example, if you give muscle relaxer to students and then give them grades, like show them that they got really bad grades on some exam, they will often, if they got muscle relaxer and their muscles were more relaxed, so they responded with more, okay, not too bad. They evaluated how bad the score was.
Wow. That's so interesting. So have you sort of thought about when people are active, you know, for example, if you've done a really hard workout and your muscles are sore because you just worked them out, does that then tell the body and the brain that it's stressed in the same way?
So this is exactly the role of the brain then to interpret the signals. This is called the field of interoception. It's one of the most interesting fields, I think, now in physiology. This is kind of the interpretation that we give to different body signals. You can take it like the sore muscles or cramped muscles, which are different type of signals, or you can take it even for the gut. Sometimes we have a pain, like a stomach pain, because we ate something bad, or it can be because we are stressed, or it can be because we are in love or something exciting. So it's almost the same kind of signal, but it gets very different interpretation by the brain. And this is part of this interoception, how you interpret these body signals. So I guess if you have multiple from all your body, you have these stress signals and they come with some kind of central brain inputs that support it, then you can even exacerbate a not so stressful situation.
So what I'm understanding is that it's really helpful to have a calm body, you know, for our brains to sort of work most effectively and our bodies to be in flow and at ease. To make it that kind of understandable, you know, if we're stressed about something, then our blood pressure might rise, right? Is it the same way that, you know, if we're not calm, then our neurotransmitters are not firing in the correct way?
Yes, I think there is a lot of meaning to what the signals that will come from the body.
So do we think that meditation would actually help?
Well, actually, there is a lot of research now on meditation and different other ways to control the physiology and to control the sympathetic nervous system, the balance between sympathetic, parasympathetic, that can be done by breath. So this is just one way in which you can regulate the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. There are the connections that there are two nervous systems that get out of the brain and control the entire body. They innervate the entire body. So the balance between them is something that will determine how the physiology will go on.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Okay. And I think it's so interesting now that we're doing this research that we actually realize some of the benefits of some of these ancient healing practices, because there's always been this segregation, hasn't there, between Western medicine and a more Eastern holistic traditional approach. But what we're finding is that acupuncture is now being accepted into the medical system in the Western world, and meditation is being seen for its benefits.
Yes, and I think there is a lot of evidence for changes in the physiology following these treatments. I think there's a lot of wisdom that accumulated over the years and practice. And I think some people who developed all these methods have some kind of basic physiological intuition. But now there are studies that actually can map connections between that all these acupuncture points, for example, they are innervated by specific type of neurons, sensory neurons. And these neurons, once you activate them, they send a signal, actually going back to the system that regulates the vagus. And then its activation will induce, as we already mentioned, the anti-inflammatory pathway. So this was a very recent study coming from Harvard that actually demonstrated that. I'm actually amazed how these ancient practitioners got to these exact points. I find it fascinating.
Yeah, definitely fascinating. I mean, we've been talking about just the mind and body, but if you think about people who work more holistically, I'm a Reiki master myself. You know, we talk about the mind, body, and spirit. So we will talk about all three of them being in balance and alignment in order for our bodies to be, you know, working to their optimal strength and health.
The concept of soul is not necessarily required to explain a lot of physiology or consciousness even. So it's something that has been debated even in philosophy, in all these theories of consciousness, and what is the meaning. It might be an entity that for some reason we need, in some schools, we need to kind of define some properties as the soul. And maybe in some other schools, it actually integrates into other definitions of mind. So I think this is something that has been, we are sometimes even stumbled by definitions.
I can understand that. So what is it you hope to do with your research?
So I guess what we are seeing is that different brain areas, which are involved in different functions, in different brain activities, in different behaviors, have different effects on the immune system and other kind of physiological processes. There are all this influx of research in ways to try to manipulate the brain. Even Elon Musk's directions of implanting electrodes and to control the brain. And I think to some extent, we will be able to use these brain areas or this understanding of the brain and try then to amend physiology or to cure disease by harnessing this brain potential.
And can you expand as well on the new therapeutic strategies that you hope to design to centrally regulate the immune responses, please?
So I think one way will be to modulate the activity of specific brain areas, for example, the reward system. So one way to do it will be by activating these brain areas with all this technology like focus ultrasound, which is non-invasive, TMS, which is a magnetic stimulation of the brain, or even implants to the brain, which is something that is done for depression and other cases. There are other brain areas, for example, that we discovered that store information about past disease that you had. And it can, by relevant triggers, just reactivate the disease and the brain can actually recreate the disease itself. So one way would be to stop the activity in this area, again, by these magnetic stimulations. We're even doing fMRI-guided neurofeedback, in which we train individuals how to control the brain based on very precise feedback from the fMRI. So I think there is a range of potential interventions that can be applied once we understand which areas we need to control, to activate or to inhibit.
So are you saying, you know, somebody who, for example, has suffered with cancer, you know, could prevent it from coming back by getting rid of that kind of past trauma of actually having had it in the first place?
Cancer is a good question. I don't know if cancer will be recorded in the same way. We showed it, for example, for autoimmune conditions like Crohn's.
Okay.
Where you have this reactivation. So you have relapsing episode built in also, or in skin, dermatitis, or all of these inflammatory conditions that patients often, they even report having some kind of emotional trigger to initiate the relapse.
I've suffered with autoimmune before in the past too, and it can move around the body. So one time it, you know, comes up as psoriasis, and then the next time it comes up as hives, and then, you know, it can change. I think if somebody has that kind of inflammatory autoimmune response in their body.
We're really in the infancy of this field, so we just don't even understand what is the true potential, what kind of information the brain records. Does it record every inflammatory state? How can it then transmit the information to the body? But I think once we understand it, either we can modulate the brain and these brain centers that store this information, or once we understand how the brain does it, maybe we can modulate something in the periphery. Or then if we see that the brain uses a certain neurotransmitter to induce the disease or the corrective response, then we can start and play with that. So I think that's kind of a chain of potential interventions we can go with once we start to decipher these connections.
And how long does that take? Because I know research takes a long time generally.
Well, I think... I feel that we were even very lucky to start doing that. So if we started about 10 years ago, just with the idea of the reward system having some effects on the immune system, and right now we have some clinical trials going on with fMRI-guided neurofeedback, I feel that 12 years, it's very fast. So, and going forward to patients will take even longer, but even just the proof of concept takes a very long time.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with all of that research. What kind of tips would you give to our audience, our listeners, to stay the most healthy that they can when we consider all of this mind-body connection?
We still don't understand how it works. And people tend to think that, well, I can just think positively and here's the proof. If I think positively, I get better. It's not necessarily think positively that what we are seeing in the brain. So I think it's important to remember that we cannot give up on all the the classical drugs. It's really important. But maybe in a way you can boost the activity of these drugs by actually supporting the body, getting the support of the natural physiology. One study I can kind of put in is the study by Alia Kroon from Stanford, where she showed that stress is bad. But if you think of stress as something that is good to you, it's not necessarily something that harms you, but actually think positively about it, then it's actually something that's protective. So I think understanding that changing states of mind is something that can be critical for your physiology.
And I think, tell me how stress can be positive.
If we don't have stress systems, we cannot survive. So these stress systems are wonderful. They can boost the body. They can initiate a lot of processes. Acute stress is something that is actually boosts the immune system. It's the chronic one that is bad, that harms the immune system. And again, it might be that it's the fear that accompanies the fact that you are stressed that is the one that's causing most of the damage. So once you change your state of mind and look on things in a more positive attitude, then you change also a lot of the physiology. She showed it also even with side effects. When people look at side effects of drugs as something that is indication that it's working, and instead of being afraid of them, then it actually improved the recovery. So I think states of mind is something very critical that can help you. But
I think that's also very hard to change.
Exactly. And I think it's also very important to remember that we don't need to get stressed because we cannot do that. People tend to kind of disregard classical medicine, but it's brought us so far and it has a lot of good effects.
Yes. And I think that there's always people who are more supportive of Western medicine and then those people who prefer a more holistic approach. And, you know, when you look at people like Joe Dispenza, who managed to cure himself through meditation and visualization, and then you hear about, manifestation techniques, for example, really talking about the subconscious and how altering the subconscious or healing like that kind kind of subconscious mind from any kind of past traumas will actually affect the conscious mind, you start to kind of understand that maybe there is something to the more holistic approach of like really kind of changing the mindset, and that enables the health of the physical body as well.
Absolutely. And I think there are some people who can do it very well. On the other hand, we had the example of Steve Jobs. I personally tried to activate my reward system. I went to the fMRI and I was surprised that I couldn't do it. So I think it's a very dangerous path to choose one, just one pathway. And especially because you really don't know. And Steve Jobs, I think, is a very sad example of that, of choosing one path instead of combining the what the conventional medicine has to offer with the potential of Western medicine and the potential of really changing your mind. I think it's important to combine.
Thank you so much. This has been such an insightful conversation. Where can people find out more about your research?
There are several publications of our work, if you just including our own papers. There are some Scientific American reports that came out on our work. You can find it in our website.
We'll make sure we put all of those links to your websites and things in the show notes, and also probably link them on our Instagram page. Instagram is like our other main portal. And of course, that is where you can go if you want to find out about any of the competitions that we have running from the show, from many of our guests that we had on the podcast. They've gifted us some things and we've got some giveaways. So check them out at becurious_podcast. I'm Louise Howe. And until next time, thank you so much to Asia, and we will see you soon. Stay curious, guys.